Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Clash of the Titans, terrifying Halloween Countdown Special!
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast where two movies with something in common go head to head to work out which one did it best. And welcome to part two of this week's Deconstruction Double. On Monday's episode, Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson postmodern the shit out of slasher movies via self-aware smash hit Scream. And today, Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard are saying anything they can do, we can do meta by undermining the entire genre with their 2012 comedy horror The Cabin in the Woods. So which of these films will satisfy our ancient ones? You're about to find out in Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Podders. I'm Chris Tilley.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
And what this episode lacks in Alex Zane, it more than makes up for with writer, director and horror expert James Moran. So, James, thank you for agreeing to finish the week with us, which is more than Alex could be bothered to do.
You're very welcome.
On Monday, we screamed. So today we're heading to Cabin in the Woods, which I'm presenting. So allow me to take you on a journey. And I'm not going to do a spoiler warning like Alex did, because we never do spoiler warnings.
No.
We just spoil everything.
Yes.
That's what you've come for. So no spoiler warning. Here we go. Five teenagers, one cabin and a ton of weed. What could possibly go wrong? A lot, as it turns out, as our young celluloid archetypes aren't simply on holiday. They're also being used in a ritual. Five sacrificial lambs being slaughtered to appease the mysterious ancient ones.
What's beneath us?
The ancient ones. The gods that used to rule the earth.
So having summoned a family of zombie redneck torturers, they are bumped off one by one. Though that weed I mentioned earlier actually saves our hero's skin, making Cabin in the Woods a resolutely pro-drug movie.
Statistical fact, cops will never pull over a man with a huge bong in his car. Why? They fear this man. They know he sees farther than they, and he will bind them with ancient logics.
However, their survival leads to the end of the world, so maybe the message is weed is bad. Either way, the film is also a brutal takedown of the genre, making the audience complicit in the horrors on screen and questioning why the world craves all this violence and death.
They want to see us punished.
Oh, this is awesome.
Whoa, no way.
The lambs have passed through the gate. They are come to the killing floor.
Get this party started!
I seriously believe something weird is going on.
What is that thing?
We have to stay together. This isn't right. We should split up.
Yeah, good idea.
Really?
We gotta get out of here.
Somebody sent those things here to get us.
You're missing the point. They want to see us punished.
So, James, do you have any kind of history with this film?
Yeah. I could not have been more excited to see this. I was well on board. I love everyone involved in making it. Love the cast. Love the creatives. So I was the perfect audience for it. I have a rule that I won't sort of slag off other people's work in public, but it'd be difficult to talk about it if there isn't some constructive criticism. It rubbed me up the wrong way, to say the least.
Interesting, Vicky. Is this the first time watch for you, Vicky?
That's yes. So interesting because. It's the first time I've seen it, and I was just, because I was wrong-footed from the start, I was so in. I just loved the fact that I didn't have a fucking clue what was going on. And I could see it on the page, and the thought of having read it, I just would have been blown away by it. I mean, it's not perfect, and we'll get there, but yeah, I have to say, I had a very good time.
I saw this one on March the 9th, 2012, and I think it was the second ever screening of this movie. So it was kind of a big deal because when it was finished, the company that made it, MGM, went bankrupt. And so this film didn't come out for 3 years. So there was a lot of anticipation around it. And I saw it at a festival in Austin where the audiences are very vocal, they're very knowledgeable, and it really did take the roof off the place. So I don't know if that maybe affected my opinion of it, but it was a really fun screening. And the only other thing I'd say on that front is since then I've made two other non-horror fans watch it, and they both loved it, which was interesting to me because I think the first sort of criticism of the film was that it'll either only work if you know horror, or if you know horror, you won't like it because of what it's got to say and the way it's taking the piss. So that was just interesting. Right, let's talk about how this film got made. Drew Goddard is the director and writer. Joss Whedon is the producer and writer. They started talking about this during their years making Buffy together. Joss says it started off as having the same central premise as Buffy in his head, which is why do these bad things keep happening to blonde girls? Drew Goddard grew up in New Mexico in a town where they make atomic weapons. And he said every day he'd see normal, decent people go to work each day and make WMDs, which was a strange juxtaposition. It was also inspired by a T-shirt that Drew Goddard bought at Comic-Con that featured a werewolf and a unicorn rearing up at each other beneath the words, "It's on now." That inspired the pair of them. But after Angel ended, they got serious about it. Joss Whedon said it's the first idea he's had that... He said it's only the second idea he's had that came to him in three acts with an ending. He felt like they were ready to go. So as we said on Monday's episode, they wrote it in 3 days. The pair of them got hotel room together, spent the morning breaking story, wrote for the rest of the day. They worked from 6 a.m. to 1 a.m. And he said they were very invested and focused in this. And within 3 days, it was all written. Although there was one little falling out they had because this was always for Joss to write and Drew to direct. And then when they'd finished it, Joss had changed his mind and said he wanted to direct.
Oh, no.
How would you feel if that happened, James, in your world?
Oh, I'd be totally fine with it. just pretty good-natured about the whole thing. These things happen. You know, fair enough.
We've just written something together. Are you going to ask to take my name off it?
Well, that's so awkward.
I've already scribbled it out.
Lovely stuff.
I could just blank it out, but I thought I'll leave the name on there and just put like a fake scribble over the top.
I'm cool with that. They were, but they figured it out. Drew Goddard got to direct it. It was his directorial debut. And just the only other thing about behind the scenes, they said that the biggest challenge they had making this film was trying to get all 200 people on set to understand the tone. And this comes up again and again when you talk about comedy and horror. Is that the biggest challenge you face when you're writing something like Cockneys and Zombies or Severance, James? Is getting the tone right throughout?
I mean, this thing, Without sort of bragging, I never seem to have a problem with it. I write horror films that are allowed to be funny if they need to be, when they need to be. If you want to call that horror comedy, then that's fine. I've stopped calling things horror comedies now because execs and marketing people get really nervous. They go, "Oh, that's going to be really hard to sell because it's two things, and audiences don't like two things in one movie, so it's going to be really difficult to sell." Which is not true at all. There's been a million horror comedies that have done perfectly well. But it's interesting that Scream in particular was sold as a scary horror film. And then when I saw it for the first time, I was really surprised how funny it was. So it wasn't sold as a horror comedy. It was just sold as a horror. So I've just started calling my stuff horror now. And then when people say that there's lots of laughs in it, then that's fine.
Just say thank you. And walk away.
Exactly. it's that tonal thing where I know what it is. I'm putting it down on the page. And then the people who read it and make the film, they don't have a problem with it. They seem to get it. I think if you know what you're doing and you put it on the page, then it will come across what the tone is. It's difficult to get tone across in an outline, but if you've got the actual script, you can tell what the tone is pretty much straight away. It's only when the thing is finished and then people who have to make trailers kind of go, "Oh, I don't know, it's two things. That's really hard." Which is not.
And this film does really throw you off as well with its prologue. You know, they say it does split into three acts, but you've also got a prologue where you meet these two characters, Citizen, played by Richard Jenkins, and Hadley, played by Bradley Whitford, and they're having a coffee. They're talking about fertility. They find out that the Stockholm experiment has failed, and now it's up to Japan and America. And we're not really understanding what they're talking about. How did you feel about this cold open, James?
I have a lot of issues with this, and I'm trying to sort of do it constructively and not just to go, "I didn't like it," because that's not helpful to anyone. I feel that it completely undermines the tension and the scares, and it tells you right up front nothing of what you're about to see in the cabin with the teenagers is in any way real. It's all being orchestrated. It's all being set up. We don't know exactly why, but it just tells you up front it's all orchestrated and it's not actually really genuine. So it kind of takes away the tension, takes away the scares, and it kind of stops you knowing who to really root for, because you're like, well, I haven't had a chance to get to know these teenagers because they're basically pawns on a stage set. So I can't really root for them. I can't really root for these people in the office who were orchestrating the murder of these teenagers. I'm not going to root for the monsters, obviously, because they're all monsters. So I don't quite know who to root for, and I'm not scared, and I don't know why I care.
The thing we come to expect from this kind of movie is for us as the audience to have the twist revealed to us at the same time the characters find out. Do you think it would be better, Vicky, if they'd saved this moment until later in the film, about the halfway point, like M. Night Shyamalan might have done?
I see what you're saying, Chris, and what you're saying, James. I think because of the way it does start, and I didn't have a clue what was happening, I couldn't hear a lot of what they were saying. They're speaking so quickly, and then that just had me hooked because I was like, right, fuck, I need to pay proper attention. But the sacrifice was made for me at that point. I knew I wasn't going to be frightened. I was just going to have a laugh because everything that James has said, you can't care. There's a moment at the midpoint where I was rooting for the kids a little bit because Richard Jenkins and what's he called? Bradley Whitford. They're the baddies at that point, but it was a very light touch thing. It didn't really matter to me all that much. But because of the dialogue, because of how quick it is, the office party, the betting pool, all the rest of it, I was like, this to me is just a comedy, and that's fine for me.
in the filmmaker's defense, this is what they said about it. They said they liked the idea of people thinking that they've walked into the wrong movie at the start.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is the words they use. Actually, they said they wanted people to be confused and intrigued,
yeah,
which it sounds like what worked on you.
Yeah.
But also, it feels like they were also, I don't know, being maybe a bit twee with what they were doing with themselves. Joss told Drew that he wanted them to put their cards on the table right away, so they then had to come up with more cards,
okay,
as the film progresses. Clearly that's worked for some of us, not for all of us.
Yeah.
So we're into the movie with these youngsters we meet. I'm going to use the name of the archetypes here just so everyone knows that these aren't my choice of words.
You're going to say whore?
Yes, I'm going to say.
Don't call that girl a whore, Chris.
We've got the scholar, who's Holden, played by Jesse Williams. The athlete, Kurt, who's played by Chris Hemsworth. The whore, Jules, who's played by Anna Hutchinson.
Take that smile off your face.
The virgin, Dana, played words. By... and Krista Connolly, and the fool, Marty, who's played by Franz Kraus. And so they're heading up to a cabin. They're not quite falling into the stereotypes that we'd expect, because we find out later why. They're actually seen quite normal, decent people from the off. But something's already happening with Jules, because they've already put chemicals in her hair dye to slow down her cognition to make her the dumb blonde.
Yeah.
And so that's already happening at this point. But, you know, Marty, I think he's already likable. The fool, the stoner.
Yes.
He already seems to be more intelligent than you would expect from that character to be, and he tells them all, "You will come to see things my way," which obviously
his only misstep when he's smoking his reefer and he's like, "Oh, you know, people are watching us. They're going to put microchips in kids' heads." I was like, "Yes, correct. Cannot wait for that day." Like, that to me is, I will rush towards that point. Progress, as far as I'm concerned. If I know where they are at all times and they can't be stolen, perfect.
Yeah.
He's an idiot.
We also meet Mortigai at this moment, the harbinger, who's a gas station attendant. And I guess this scene would maybe be more interesting if, as you say, we didn't know what was happening beforehand. We could think we were being cleverer than the film by saying, oh, this is a cliche.
But it is funny.
It's funny. Did you like him?
Oh, come on. Am I on speakerphone? That's funny.
What did you think about when we got to the cabin, James, and we start we first come across this mirror that's a two-way mirror, so you can see into someone else's room.
Well, they don't really do anything with it. It's just a here's a creepy thing that we've just popped in. It doesn't bear any relation to the plot. It's not really used for anything. It's kind of a joke. It doesn't really. And also the whole time I'm going, well, those guys are underground, aren't they? They're doing stuff. They've set all this up. And why have they put the mirror there? Why is that? And that's, you don't want the audience thinking that. Like, well, why has that happened? Why have they done that? Why don't they do this instead? You do not want the audience thinking that. So I'm just waiting for the guys underground to start doing stuff, because I know this is all staged. So
yeah, but I also feel like it's trying to get us to think about voyeurism.
I think it wrongfoots us a bit, because if there's a two-way mirror, which is used to spy on people, but there is no spying going on within that cabin itself. It's all done through cameras and whatever. So, yeah, unless it's going to be a really fun reveal later, just tell me what you... because I've only seen this once, what you thought. I got really distracted by and a bit obsessed with, and it ruined the film a little bit for me, about where exactly we were. With the control room, were we in the real world, but an enhanced real world? Because there's obviously a lot of dabbling and mythical creatures and whatever else going on. For ages, I thought we were in purgatory. And so that ruined it for me, because that is not the real world, obviously. And I thought that, you know, because they keep talking about the phone call coming from upstairs and downstairs. I was like, well, obviously heaven and hell. So we're in purgatory. Oh, no, we're not. And it ruined the midsection for me, because I couldn't get my foot in with it. But then maybe it was supposed to, and I was just being a bit nitpicky.
When I got a little bit of the voyeurism thing, because they sort of explicitly mention it later on. When the two characters are about to have sex, and she starts taking off her shirt, and one of the office guys is like, "Oh, do we need to see this?" And he's like, "Yeah, well, you know, we're not the only ones watching. Got to keep the customers satisfied." And I just think, okay, so you're referring to the ancient gods down below who have to see the boobs for this archetypal story to happen, but you're kind of implying that me as an audience member wants to see the boobs as well, because I'm stupid and that I just want to see the same story. So I never like it when a movie goes, maybe you, the audience, are the real villain. You're complicit because you're watching this movie. I'm like, you made it and you told me
to watch it. So.
But are they not sort of having a go at the conversations that directors feel that they have to have in this genre when really they don't have to have these conversations?
Yes,
aren't they kind of?
But at the same time, if you're doing the very thing that you're supposedly parodying, then you're doing that same thing. It's like, it's all very well to say, you know, it's a bit cheesy when some horror movies have a booby shot, and it is, and that's a perfectly valid thing to say. But if you then just have a long lingering shot of one of your lead actress's tits, then you're just doing the same thing. And I felt very uncomfortable watching that again, as I did the first time. And I was like, this is kind of embarrassing. And in the first 5 minutes, the lead actress, she's just sort of wandering around in her underwear.
Is,
and we've got like very close-up shots of her.
Yeah, I agree with you. It needs to be smarter.
Sound like a Victorian gentleman.
She's there. She's no woman ever forgets to put her fucking trousers on. So Chris Hemsworth's like, you're not wearing pants. She's like, oh, what am I like? It's like, no one has ever done that. You do not wear the top half of your clothes and no bottom half. But it is a common trope.
Isn't that Jules that happens too, though?
No, it's our heroine.
Oh,
so she's just doing stuff. She's doing like a full day's worth of jobs. She's like, I'm going to pack my bit. She's not like, oh, I'm just in the middle of getting dressed. She's forgotten to put trousers on. But I thought
and this is before they get to the cabin. Yeah. Before she's been infected by any pheromones.
Yeah, so it just needs to be smarter about, I see that scene. I see a girl like that. And it's like, okay, I know where I am. I understand why I'm seeing that. I'm not happy about it, but there it is. And it needs a Scream caliber line to make me laugh along with it and get the joke a bit more rather than, oh, you forgot to put your pants on.
Regarding Jules' breasts, on the commentary, Drew and Joss say that it was important to them that the nudity stopped as soon as she was in distress or pain.
Oh, well, great guys.
Oh, that's totally fine then.
It's important.
Yeah, we just showed several minutes of it first, but then, you know, we've got standards.
Yeah,
we stopped as soon as there was violence.
Men.
But this doesn't. Awful lot of shots of her dancing around in very tight shorts and a crop top and bending over and like lots of low angles of the women as they're walking away and sort of panning up their legs. And it's like, guys, it's, you know, if it was the 50s, I, fair enough. When you're appealing to teenage boys in drive-thrus, but I mean, come on, this is especially when you're saying this is a bad thing and we're kind of making a comment on it. If you're just doing the same thing, then you're not making a comment. You're just having your cake and eating it.
The five of them head into a basement full of nightmares and horror knickknacks. They pick a bunch of different things, little realizing that whichever one they choose will be how they get killed. And it ends up being the diary of Patience Buckner, who's a member of the zombie redneck torture family, the Buckners. And so this is when Act Two begins, when the Buckners attack. We talked a bit about the fact what happens here. So it's sort of, we're in slasher territory now. The redneck zombies come and kill and beat people up, and we think that Marty's dead, but he gets killed off screen. And also we're going back to the other plot line where we're seeing how they're kind of celebrating. Are they above ground? I'm getting confused now, or are they below ground?
Well, wasn't clear. I was like, oh, it's a nightmare factory. Okay, fine. In the real world, in quote marks. Oh, no, it's not, because of the ritual. So we're in a sort of supernatural realm somewhere. Oh, no, we're not, because we're having an office party. And I like it as set pieces. I think the office party is very funny. And I think Bradley Whitford's line, because he's obsessed with the merman and he loses the bet because it's the Buckners that come to kill the kids. And he's talking about Chris Hemsworth. And he's like, but he had the conch in his hands. That made me laugh my head off. I thought that was brilliant. But I still wasn't sure where I was.
And in that scene, actually, Chris Hemsworth delivers a speech trying to G them all up in it when they're still in the cabin. And apparently they were so impressed with those dailies, Joss Whedon sent them back to the studio. And within 2 days, he'd been cast in Red Dawn and as Thor off the back of one speech, because they said, we've got a movie star here.
He's good.
We also cut to Japan. How do you feel about what was happening in Japan, James?
I mean, this is the thing. I love the concept. It's a great concept. It's a great idea that this whole slash thing is a ritual that appeases ancient gods to not end the world. So, you know, just taking it from that point of view, I love that you see glimpses of the other rituals around the world, and that. I think that was one of the few things where I kind of went, oh, that's funny, because this is kind of like the stereotypical Japanese horror movie moment where it's a girl with her hair over her face and there's little schoolgirls. Mm. And I appreciated that because, you know, by that point you kind of know what's going on. But I mean, I did enjoy lots of moments in the thing. But because I'd been annoyed right from the beginning and it just started annoying me more and more as it went on, I kind of couldn't really enjoy them as much.
I enjoyed Kiko's spirit living on in the Happy Frog, though. And I actually, it's nicely buttoned with Richard Jenkins just shouting "fuck you" to these really cute Japanese children. But as we move on, Marty isn't dead. Oh, sorry, we've got Chris Hemsworth. We've got the jock's death.
This annoyed me a lot. Still annoys me because when I first saw the laser net, when the kids are in the van and they're going to the cabin, I was like fucking love this film. Like, where did that come from? However, by the rules of that, the rules of the film itself, Chris Hemsworth's death into the laser net shouldn't count because he doesn't bring it on himself. That's an artificial way of him dying. Basically, if he'd done the jump, the motorbike jump, and he'd fucked it up because he was too proud or he was too cocky or he was too whatever and he just didn't make it, then he can die within the rules of the film. But if you can be killed so swiftly, why not just, the minute they all come out of the RV through the tunnel, just kill them all, just chop their heads off? There's the idea that if they break the rules, they will die. And I don't see what rule he broke apart from flying into a net that they put there. That's not fair.
Really, really good point. They could just, as soon as they arrive in the van, just stop the van, get them all out, and then just shoot them in the head one by one. Done in 2 minutes.
Yes. Isn't the rule he's broken being turning into an alpha male bully?
Yeah, but it's the method, isn't it? It's their thing. The net is theirs. It doesn't exist within nature. It doesn't exist within our nightmares, particularly. So it's too. It doesn't make sense within their rules.
Why trigger a storyline about zombies? Yep. If he's then going to be killed by the special laser net dome thing.
Yep.
And also, you kind of give that away in the first few minutes of the film. If we hadn't known about that, again, I keep coming back to this. If we hadn't known about that, and we thought, oh, he might actually make this jump, so we're worried that he might not make the jump and fall down, we are not going to expect him to smash into some invisible barrier. That would have been such a big shock.
Yeah, it relies on you having forgotten about it. And there would, even if they did it like that, there'd still be work to do with having a rule, which I'm not aware of, which is like just being too cocksure will get you killed. But that's not really true.
Yeah. So you know he's gonna die at that point. So that, again, any time there could be a moment of tension or suspense or scare, they undermine it so that you just don't feel anything. It's like, well, this is where he dies.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
So Dana ends up underwater but survives, makes her escape to the surface. The Buckners try to kill her, but Marty saves her because Marty wasn't really dead. And so we've got our two heroes for the final act. And as they called it on the commentary, the moment the elevator door closes on these two, that's when Act 3 begins. So we clock the monsters that they could have battled, including a werewolf, a wraith, a hell lord who's very pinhead, a sugar plum fairy. We see a spider, a clown, a robot, Fornicus, the lord of bondage and pain. I looked him up. I like that name. And my favourite ones, one of the monsters was apparently called Balding Menace, which is what I might call myself from now on.
I don't think you should.
And at this point, we hear the director's voice. Who explains to them it's a woman's voice, and the woman explains to them that deaths are inevitable and necessary. They're part of something bigger and older that they could never imagine. To placate the ancient ones, they're pissed off, so they do a system purge. Now, this film was written to get to this moment of chaos, they said. You know, that was the idea, and how do we work back from there? But so this button, you press the button, all the monsters are released, and they start killing the facility security team and everyone there. Why would they need this button is my question.
It's a good question. Why have the one button that can fuck it all up and make it big?
That's funny that you like the film and that's the one thing you have an issue with. That's the one thing. That's the one thing where I'm like, actually, that is the moment in the film where I'm like, okay, now I love it because now I don't know what the fuck's going to happen because everything's gone wrong.
It might also be my favourite moment in the film. We haven't got there yet, but it was just funny to me that someone built that into the system. We need one button that releases everything at one time.
Yeah, it's like, why would we need that? Should we maybe have a key or something? Should there be a key? No, I've put a little plastic over it, so you know, so you have to flip it up before you press the button.
That'll stop him.
And it means we get to see a dragon bat as well. In that scene, apparently Bradley Whitford was firing his machine gun like it was the best day of his life. So Joss had to go over to him and tell him, actually, this is the worst day of your character's life. So stop being so happy. And then we're into the final straight, really. We end up in the ritual chamber where we meet the director, and she's played by Sigourney Weaver. Although certainly at my screening, everyone had figured it out by then because her voice is so recognisable.
Yeah.
It's great casting, though. It's one of those casting moments where it does a lot for that character already just by having her walk in with her presence. And she talks a fair amount of sense. Although she's telling them that they're being killed for being young. It's different in every culture and it's changed over the years, but always required youth. So everyone on this podcast, I reckon, is safe from this.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Sorry, James. So we find out that if Marty lives to see the sun come up, the world will end. They're having an interesting philosophical debate, and then Dana grabs the gun and goes to shoot Marty. What were you thinking at this point, James?
Well, that's the moment where I thought, oh my God, if she actually just kills him, and saves the world. Wouldn't that be really horrible, or a really awful thing to happen to her character? And that'd be a real sort of down ending. But then ultimately, you know, this is real. These are real ancient gods, and it has really saved the world. So she has saved the world, but she gets to spend her whole life being miserable that all her friends are dead, and she is responsible for the death of her best friend. Wouldn't that be a hot? And then, of course, they didn't do that.
Mm.
So would you have preferred it if it had that more?
The one time they could have gone for a shock or you know, a proper horror moment, they don't do it. And, you know, and it's nice that they do end. It's fun that they end the world and we see it happen. Because at the same time, it's like, do you really want to be part of this system where you are slaughtering innocent teenagers every single year just in the hope that it works? But yeah, I think that would have been a real shocker and a real down moment. But that's not really what they were going for.
So as you say, she doesn't end up killing Marty. A werewolf shows up. Patience Buckner shows up. The director dies. The werewolf and Patience die. And then the two of them are left sparking up a joint, have a funny little conversation. And then they say they look forward to seeing the Ancient Ones, and the chamber shakes and rumbles and starts to collapse. And then a huge hand bursts up through the facility and smashes through the cabin in the woods. And that is your ending. How did you feel about that end, Vic?
This is so pedantic, but because it took me this long to realise, oh, we are in the real world, then I was like, okay, fine. And then I sort of missed, I was distracted. And so it was only at this point that I knew where we were and not in purgatory, which I just got really hung up on. Mm. And so I was like, oh yeah, cool. I get it. And that's good. I love the fact that it's like, there isn't going to be a sequel, is there? Like, no. If you're Joss Whedon, then it's fine. You can do that. But it just the idea of like cut to black and it's like, there is nothing else. This is it, like this sort of perfect project. I love the hubris of it, to be honest. But I did think that Dana was gonna, yeah, maybe either go the way that James has said, or that sort of end up working for them. I thought that would have been, you'd have to do so much character work to make that such a surprise. But maybe she gets recruited, so you know she starts off and she's perfectly innocent and all the rest of it, and then she's recruited to the dark side. I would have quite liked that.
Yeah, but then she's like, here's how we're gonna make it better and how we're gonna make it not as painful for these people. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's like, I'm gonna try and make things better for you know, if these people have to die every year, we're going to make it so that we get something good out of it, as well as saving the world.
I think she might have walked in with that intention and be like, I'm going to sort this shit out, and then got in there and be like, this is so cool and awesome, I'm going to be even worse than the people that went before me.
Completely.
That's the way I would
have done it. That's what you would have to do just to make it even more horrible. But this is the thing, they're not trying to make a horrible, scary horror movie. They're satirizing it. It just, I mean, you know, to compare it to Scream, Scream's written and made by someone who has loved the horror genre their whole life, is obsessed with horror, and wants to do something they haven't seen yet and use the tropes and cliches to have some fun and entertain an audience. This is made by people who seemed to not like horror movies at the time and go, oh, I would love horror if only it was proper horror. So here's all the things that are wrong with horror that we think, and we're going to fix it. And it just, and I think that's why I just kept getting so annoyed in the cinema, because it felt like I was just sitting watching a horror movie with somebody sitting next to me just whispering in my ear going, horror is really stupid, isn't it? Horror is really shit. People are like, horror must be really stupid. It's not a proper movie if it's horror. And it just felt like that all the way through, and it really angered me. And I'm sure that couldn't have been the intention. I don't think they wanted to anger people.
I don't think so.
I'm sure they did want to make something.
I think that's how it works.
And there is lots of stuff I love in there. I think it's an amazing concept. The fact that this is why these things keep happening in horror movies, it's because there's these ancient gods that demand to see it. And that's really fun. That's a really cool, I love the archetypes and the character tropes and the little sacrificial stones and everything. I think it's a really great, clever idea. And then the whole logic of, well, then you'd have to have a whole team of people with a base and operating, and how would that work? I just think it's a great concept. Unfortunately, it just seems to be made by people who don't like horror. I'm sure I'm wrong. I'm sure they love horror, but it just, that's how it comes across. And if it comes across that way, then it hasn't worked for me.
I'm really concerned we're giving you PTSD here.
I watched it opening weekend. I had not watched it again since, and I rewatched it for this. And that's the last time I'll watch it.
I'm sorry we put you through this. Giving you flashbacks. Okay, shall we do the bits then?
Yeah.
James, what was your favourite scene?
this is going to be ironic, as you will find out from what I say later on. My favourite scene, my favourite moment, is when the merman comes out and you realise what it is.
Yes!
And he goes, oh, come on. And I remember laughing very, very loudly in the cinema because I was like, this feels like it's delivering on what the movie, the intention of the movie was. It's like, here's how we're gonna take horror and we're gonna surprise you, we're gonna subvert it, we're gonna do something you don't expect. And that was a moment where I was like, that's the perfect bit that I felt it delivered on.
Vicky, what's yours?
The nightmare cubes, I shall call them, when we get to see, so the slow sort of reveal of all your different nightmares. And the reason I loved it so much is, you know, the montage in Ghostbusters where the city's like melting down and everything kicks off and you've got the ghoul driving the cab and then Slimer's going nuts. I love that montage so much. And this was that, but modern and updated. And it was like seeing old friends. Like, I used to love monsters and creatures around that age. And I've sort of gone off it a bit as I've got older, but to see all the creatures that you just listed, it was like seeing my old friends, and I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, when they press that purge button, you are not disappointed by the results. They definitely deliver on that.
Alex has just texted me his favourite stuff, his bits, and him and I have both picked the system purge. That's our favourite scene for all the reasons we've listed. MVW, Vicky.
Bradley Whitford. I don't have to explain it. I just have a blind spot for that man, a soft spot for that man. He can do no wrong. Have you seen The Handmaid's Tale? He's fucking great in that. So that's that.
Alex went for him or the evil unicorn. So as you've gone Bradley Whitford, Alex is going for the evil unicorn. James, what's your most valuable whatever?
Merman.
me too.
It's because
when
it's
blood comes through the blowhole.
Yes, because it's not just like a really satisfying payoff to a setup. Yeah. It's a great monster. It's a really funny that it happens to be him, and then they don't have to have the blood coming out the blowhole.
No,
but it's the cherry on the icing on the cake that just makes it even more perfect.
The weird thing is watching the behind-the-scenes stuff on this film, as I said in the previous episode, Heather Langenkamp, who plays Nancy in Nightmare on Elm Street, did the effects on this. So she's explaining how she and her husband created the merman.
Awesome.
And they're showing it's spraying blood like a fire hydrant, and it's way over the top. And so they ended up not using that version because it was too much. You realise there's a specific amount of blood that should come out of a merman for it to be funny. and then if you could change anything, what would that be? I feel like we got time for this, James.
I've thought this for years, and when I started rewatching it, I was like, oh, maybe it wouldn't work. But now I've rewatched it for my second time ever, I think it actually would work. Imagine if you'd gone in and you'd started watching a slasher movie, some fun teens, you'd taken some time to introduce them so that we realize that it's not just a jock and a whore and a virgin and a fool. So before it says that they're acting out of character, get to know them, get to love them, kind of fall for them a bit. Take them to a creepy cabin. They start realizing something's not right here. They're acting out of character. There's weird shit going on. Stuff comes out the ground. There's zombies. There's this. There's that. The other. And then the kid finds a mic. And then they find that hatch. They go down, and that's when you discover that there's a whole underground base. Mm. And you can literally, and I was watching it very forensically. You could just cut out all of those scenes up until the point where Sigourney Weaver's voice starts, and it would still make sense because she explains it all anyway. So
yeah,
it all. I mean, you'd lose the merman, which is sad.
It is.
But but can you imagine how much more shocking that would have been to discover there was this? And you could have had even more fun with the whole slasher tropes. And it's like, why is that happening? That doesn't make any sense. Why is there a zombie suddenly? What's this? What's that? And I feel like it would have made it an actual proper horror movie, and then had a massive twist. And then I think I would have loved it, because when you're making a meta horror, and Scream does this perfectly, you can be meta, you can subvert it, but you still have to deliver on the genre. Like if you're doing a meta slasher, I still want the third act to be a slasher. You know, I still want somebody in a mask chasing people around and killing people. If there's people in a cabin in the woods and zombies, I want you to deliver on that. And there's very, very little zombie action. And it doesn't deliver on what it promises. It just feels like a great big setup for a punchline that doesn't land because they've told you the punchline at the start of the film. I'm very tempted to actually do a video edit and do that and show it to someone who hasn't seen it.
I would totally watch that.
Like a YouTuber, yes.
I would totally watch that. And your change is actually making me potentially change my mind about the verdict coming up. But Vicky, what would you change?
Establish the world quicker, the underground world, for dummies like me. They were like, make it more obvious that it's not purgatory and it's a sort of military type setting. I kept thinking God was going to walk in. And then you see Sigourney Weaver and you're like, are you God? Because to me, that's like a big piece of casting. It's like she could have been like, so I am the man upstairs. Anyway, or just for the fucking shits and giggles of it, have the Nightmare Cube people, monsters and spooks, work together. So what they do is the purge button unleashes them and they just go, they kill anything they can see. Maybe just one joke where they team up and they're using intelligence to do something bigger.
I like it.
Thanks.
Alex would recast Sigourney Weaver. And he says, no, he's got a good point here. He says, it's because I love Sigourney Weaver, but she's playing exactly the same character that she played in Paul the year before, which is true.
Okay, yeah.
And so he thought that sort of it spoilt it for him a little bit. And it is true. It's a weird thing that she played that part twice. I like the idea of every country having their own version of this story. And I wanted to see more of the J-horror or what was going on. It looked like King Kong was in Argentina. So yeah. I would like to have seen a bit more of all that stuff. And that's that. All right. We're coming up to the verdict. So which of these films gives you a husband's bulge?
Lovely. What a nice note to end on.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Vicky, do you want to go first?
I will go first. I don't think I'm going to say it as eloquently as my colleagues. So I'm going to pick Scream because it is a slasher movie as well as sending up sounds too light, but you know what I mean. It's what James has already said. It's meta and that's satisfying and fun and it was so surprising and so refreshing at the time, but it still is the thing it's supposed to be. Whereas Cabin in the Woods, I had such a good time and I'd watch it again and I'd laugh my head off, but it isn't the thing it's supposed to be. It's something else for me.
I'm going to go next because I think I know what's happening here. I love both these movies. I enjoy, I love the characters and the dialogue. It's so much more memorable in Scream. I appreciate the brutality of that film. But I also love how Cabin in the Woods keeps pulling the rug from under you. I enjoyed being in on the joke. Unlike maybe everyone else here today. And I liked how both sides have these belief systems and you can kind of understand where both sides of this film are coming from. And so, you know, you keep switching your allegiances. But I like how it demands more from the horror genre and maybe even science in general. So for those reasons, as much as I love Scream, I'm voting for Cabin in the Woods.
Whoa.
So, James, it's coming. Alex has sent me his vote, but as he's not at the table, he doesn't get a vote here. So, James, you're the decider. I don't know if there's that much suspense here.
There's no suspense whatsoever. much like Cabin in the Woods. So, my answer is Scream, obviously, because it's flawless. It revitalized the horror genre in a good way, and it's made with love, and it only did good things.
So Scream is the winner. Well done, Scream. Alex isn't here, as I said, so he doesn't get a vote. But he messaged me and said, I love the mythology of Cabin in the Woods. I love the twists, but mainly I'm picking it because I love the monsters. And genuinely, the moment those lift doors open and all hell floods out is one of my favourite movie moments in the last 10 years. So it would have been a draw if he'd been here. And anyway, the vote when it's a draw goes to our guest. So Scream was always going to be the winner. Right, we can't tell you what we are doing next week, as this is the first time you are telling us what to watch. And if you've been following the poll on our Twitter, you already know which films have won, which is weird as I haven't even posted that poll yet. So please check out @ClashPod if you want to know what to watch. Don't forget to subscribe and rate and give us a funny review, as they make a smile and might mean I can start making some money out of this bloody thing. Well, if you want to send us an email, the address is show@clashpod.com. And finally, thank you for being such an amazing guest, James.
Can I just apologise to Drew Goddard, who I am a huge fan of? And I'm sure the intention was not to upset me.
Do you think it was just one long con like this will really get to you?
It just didn't work for me. I'm terribly sorry. Love your other work.
But if this wasn't too painful, will you please come visit with us again?
I would love to, yes. I'm sorry, my Siri on my watch went off as I was in the middle of saying something just then. It keeps picking up my voice as when I lift my wrist, even though I've turned that off.
Is it trying to play you Cabin in the Woods? Change your mind!
I think it is.
It's the ancient ones. Right, that's your lot. As ever, thank you for listening and goodbye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.